morning and welcome to the Third Degree Climate Justice Radio here on 2CR 107.3.
Yep, and we're the show that asks you to ask the question, is 3 degrees of warming too much?
Or in the case of Professor Ross Garnaut this week, is 4 or 5 or whatever he's saying he's putting us in for now, is that too much?
Yeah, that's exactly the question. And so we're going to be having a bit of a chat about what's happening with Garnaut. And we're also going to be speaking to Liv Negro from the Darwin Aboriginal Rights Coalition about uranium mining in the Northern Territory.
But first up, we'll be talking about the Climate Protection Bill, which is a private member's bill soon to be before Parliament.
Yeah. Yep, and we're going to be joined right now on the line with Nina Hall from Climate Action Coogee. Hi, Nina. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Libby.
And you're going to be speaking with us about the Climate Protection Bill. Could you give us a bit of an overview about what that is?
Okay, it's pretty exciting because Australia, although there's a lot of discussion and all sorts of positive things coming out of the government at the moment about climate change, there's no single comprehensive piece of legislation that addresses climate change, unlike in the UK, where they have the Climate Change Bill about to be passed in Parliament or to be given royal assent as it happens over there. And it's quite an exciting story of how community groups around Australia decided to write their own bill for Australia. And at the moment we're poised on presenting it to Parliament House next weekend on Sunday the 21st of September.
Wow. And what are some of the specific demands that are being made?
All right. Do you want me to tell you a bit about the story of the bill, or I'll tell you about the actual bill?
Yeah, let's have the story first.
Okay, because it's quite inspiring. So back in 2005, the UK was also lacking a piece of legislation that really addressed climate change, not just addressing how much emissions it should reduce, but how to adapt to the future that will be very different once further impacts of climate change occur. So Friends of the Earth in the UK and WWF, two big environmental groups, wrote a piece of legislation that addressed these issues. And it was introduced for debate into Parliament. And those green groups in the UK have a lot of community support, lots of small community chapters. And so they got in touch through a whole number of ways, through postcards and concerts and letters and emails, and they asked as many people who cared in the UK to contact their local politician, their local MP, to support the climate change bill in the UK when it came up for debate in Parliament. As a result of this request, 130,000 people contacted their MPs, and the result was that 400 MPs voted in support of the climate change bill. And when it receives royal assent in later this month in the UK, it'll mean that the UK is the first country to pass strong targets beyond its commitments under the Kyoto Protocol. So I started to work with my own local group, which is Climate Action Coogee, to write the Climate Protection Bill, as it's now known. And we worked in collaboration with 30 other climate action groups around Australia by email and by phone. And we've written this beautiful piece of legislation, and I say it's beautiful because it hasn't been passed through Parliament yet, so it hasn't been through any of the awful compromising and political dealing that may occur. And you can read the Climate Protection Bill. It's on the website under Climate Movement, one word, climatemovement.org.au/climateprotectionbill. And so we've settled on 50% cuts to our emissions by 2020 based on 1990 levels, and 100% cuts on our emissions by 2050, also based on 1919 levels, which are more significant than what the Labor government's proposing of 60% by 2050 based on 2000 levels. So that's almost twice what we're half of what we're asking for. Now, that bill has been endorsed by thousands of people around Australia through their climate action groups, and individuals as well. And one very forward-thinking, open-minded politician is Tony Windsor, who's the member for New England. And he has drafted the Climate Protection Bill into a private member's bill and is poised to present it to Parliament later this year.
So to coincide with the bill being presented to Parliament, there's going to be a climate rally happening in Canberra. Can you tell us about that?
On Sunday, September the 21st, at Federation Mall in Canberra at 12:30. So start planning your weekend trip now. We will be taking not just the bill to Parliament House, but we'll be taking it there on foot and on bike, reflecting the clean energy way of moving, and taking 10,000 signed postcards in support of the bill from people all over Australia who care, and presenting that to Parliament House.
So what other ways can people show their support for the bill?
Well, we have a great website, which also has the bill on it, as well as all sorts of things you can do, called climateride.org.au, Climate Ride's one word. And on there, you can add your support for the bill. You can ask requests for some postcards to be sent out, at this stage sent out in express post, to sign your support. And, of course, contacting your local politician makes a huge difference, because they assume that people don't care unless they hear from them.
I guess just recently we've had Garneau's interim, or what's his...
There was a supplementary report just last Friday.
Garneau's trajectories supplementary report released last week. Some of those figures there are quite different from the ones in the climate protection bill. What do you think of the interim targets Garneau's asking for?
Look, it's really disappointing, because Garneau's initial reports, because this is probably the fourth that he's brought out, and we are looking forward to seeing the final report he brings out at the end of this month. Up till now, it was very inspiring to see that a neoliberal economist such as Professor Garneau was exposing himself to the scientific analysis on climate change and starting to say some really impressive statements that showed that he understood the science and that he realised what kind of predicament we're in unless we start making some strong decisions and political and legislative decisions now globally about reducing our emissions. But last Friday's report was a real disappointment, because it seems like Professor Garneau is starting to play a bit of a political game, and he presented some very, very low targets for 2020. It was 5% if no other country decides to do anything, or 10% if other countries commit to cutting their emissions further. Whereas, obviously, the climate protection bill is asking for 50%. And the reason we want a higher target by 2020 is because we need for emissions to peak in 2010 and decline as soon as they can after that.
Great. Thanks a lot, Nina.
Thanks very much for that.
No worries. Thanks, Libby. Thanks, James.
And if you want to support the bill, head down to Canberra on the 21st for the climate protection rally. And you can find details on our website, which is climateradio.blogspot.com.
So as we touched on there at the end, this is bringing us up to our big burning issue of the week.
Oh, it's burning. It's hot.
Yeah, it's
so
burning.
Hot.
It's burning my soul, James.
Oh, dear.
Last Friday, the federal government's climate change advisor, Professor Ross Garneau, delivered the emissions target that he thinks Australia should aim to achieve. As Nina mentioned, he's called for Australia to cut 10% of carbon emissions based on levels from year 2000 by 2020. But if other developed countries opt out of previously stated cut targets, Garneau has suggested a 5% target. Environment groups have labelled both targets as soft, suggesting that 25 to 40% reductions are the minimum required. And our Third Degree's Nick Collins spoke with John Connor, CEO of the Climate Institute, and also David Spratt, the author of Climate Code Red.
Look, this is a deeply disappointing and bleak outlook on the global negotiations, and we think is up on the global negotiations at a critical point when we're starting to make some progress. But, of course, when we're also feeling the brunt of climate change in places like the Murray.
How significant is Australia's role? Like, if we adopt soft targets, what kind of influence could this have?
Australia came in from the cold in Bali with its ratification of Kyoto and added absolutely significant momentum to those global talks. A 10% target will put us right back on the sidelines where we were through the Howard years, and will be irrelevant to achieving the goals that, in fact, the Garneau Review talks about. So we think it's actually a significant loss. Australia can be a very heavy player in those negotiations, and we don't think now is the time to pull out of those in the way in which Garneau suggests.
Now facing wide criticism, how might Garneau influence the emissions debate?
Oh, look, I've always said that the Garneau review was an important part of it and was always going to be an important contribution to the debate. It is. These aren't flippant comments. It is with a heavy heart that I think the Garneau review make these comments, but I do think that it's too early to make the calls that they've made. There's been some movement in the latest climate talks in Accra in Ghana. Let's not turn back from that. Let's go forward. But we're going to need policies, not just carbon prices. We're going to need policies to bring on clean energy and new technologies, and we're going to need to do that even quicker now.
I asked David Spratt, author of Climate Code Red, what was the Garneau report's terms of reference?
He was engaged to report them on how an emissions trading scheme might be developed. So it was actually a very narrow terms of reference. They didn't say to him, what's the science of climate change? How bad is it? What would we have to do to get back to a safe climate? None of those questions were asked or answered in the Garneau report.
The Garneau report's called for 10% emission reductions by 2020. With his thoughts, David Spratt.
This is an entirely disingenuous debate that we're having. I mean, what these people don't seem to realise is that if temperature gets to 2 degrees or 3 degrees, certainly it's 3 degrees, and all the climate scientists are saying this, we will actually pass a number of tipping points, which means that there are dominoes in the climate system, and once one tips over, it tends to knock over the next one, and the temperature won't stop at 3 degrees because we will be releasing large amounts of methane from melting permafrost and this sort of thing, and the temperature will go to 5 or 6, at which point most of the world is uninhabitable and most people and most species won't have a future on this planet. Now, Garneau in his report vaguely says 5 or 6 degrees would be very bad, what he calls the bad impacts, but he doesn't understand that the targets he's putting out are consistent with actually reaching those bad impacts.
What then of the present day? Where are we at now?
We're at a bit less than 1 degree of warming at the moment, with more in the system for the amount of greenhouse gases we put up there. This year in the Arctic, in the last few days, the Arctic ice has melted so much that both the Northwest and the Northeast passages are open for the first time since human civilization was established. 80% by volume of the Arctic sea ice in summer is now gone. This is 100 years ahead of the predictions of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and it means that the Arctic system is changing so quickly, is degrading so quickly that an organisation like the World Wildlife Fund, which is a fairly conservative green organisation, says it is no longer trying to protect the Arctic ecosystem because it's no longer possible to do so. It's already gone. Why does that matter? Because when all that ice in the Arctic in summer, which is roughly the size of Australia, goes, and it will in the next 5 years, light reflective ice will be replaced by dark sea, and the Arctic will warm really rapidly by about 5 degrees. That will melt the Greenland ice sheet, and 7 metres of sea level rise are in the offing. I mean, these are impacts for which we have already started the dominoes falling, and they're just not part of this debate. We can't bet on the bad outcomes not happening because the emissions, the rate at which carbon dioxide is going up into the air, the projected future emissions are all at the bad end of the predictions. Everything's happening more quickly at lower temperatures than were predicted, and we're sitting around saying, I wonder if it's real or not.
And that was The Third Degree's Nick Collins speaking with David Spratt, author of Climate Code Red. So where do we start, James? What's the most burning issue here for you?
It's hard, and I think Nina picked up on it before from Climate Action, could you, we were talking to, that there seems to be a bit of a gap here between what Professor Garneau says we need scientifically to avoid sort of mass destruction and what he's actually advocating here. And
yeah,
it's sad and it's a bit depressing because he says that we really need to aim for an objective of 450 parts per million with you know, the idea of trying to get to 400 parts per million at some point in the future. But he doesn't think that anyone's going to, he doesn't think there's going to be a global agreement at this time on a 450 parts per million scenario. So he's now suggesting or recommending to the government he choose a 550 parts per million scenario.
Yeah, it seems a little bit like, I don't know, digging your own grave or self-fulfilling prophecy, like this idea that, well, you know, we're never going to be able to do it, so we won't even try. So, of course, we're not going to be able to do it because we're not even trying to do it. Like, it just seems to me like the new climate skepticism is, yeah, we now recognize that climate change is real, but we don't actually, we're skeptical about our own capacity to change, which I think we really do have a capacity to do.
And it really is a self-fulfilling prophecy. The fact that he will only recommend 450 parts per million if the rest of the world agrees on that. So when it comes to Copenhagen in December 2009, when the world meets to agree on what to do post-Kyoto, what kind of agreement and what targets to aim for, of course it's going to be impossible for there to be a global agreement of 450 if Kano is saying 550, but he's only going to say 450 if people agree on 450.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's this weird, like, it's this, catch
yeah.
22 almost.
Exactly.
It's ridiculous.
It's such an ugly, like, negotiating sort of, you know, me too, I'm not going to try and do my best if you're not. I don't understand what Garnaut's role actually is. Is he supposed to be giving conservative predictions? Like, isn't his role to be saying, you know, what we need to reduce by in order to stop dangerous climate change, and then the government from that makes their choices? How does it actually work?
Well, you know, the Garnaut is there to recommend policies for the government, but the thing which, you know, we seem to forget is that Garnaut's terms of reference, the terms of reference which you can report on, have been set by the government. And so the Rudd Labor government specifically asked Garnaut to look at their policy of 60% reductions of 2000 levels. And so they've told Garnaut to look at the two scenarios, 450 and 550. So for the idea that Garnaut can't actually look at anything lower than 450, even if he wanted to. I guess he fails to really take into account is just how severe the threat is going to be a lot of the time.
Mm.
And I think that is really seen in his interim targets, where he's mentioned 5 and 10% by 2020. And he still believes that if we aim for a 10% reduction by 2020, that we can still hit this 80 or 90% reduction by 2050.
Yeah, but how are we going to get there if we haven't been putting in the stuff before?
And David Spratt mentioned before about some of these positive, negative feedback systems, or these feedback loops, and the tipping point, which is really approaching when we hit 2 degrees of warming above, you know, post-industrial times. You know, once we hit 2 degrees of warming, which we're going to be probably locked in for by the time 2020 comes, if the world's only reduced by 5 or 10%, we're going to see these negative feedback systems, as he said, the permafrost letting off its methane, the oceans becoming acidified and spewing out CO2, not being able to absorb CO2. So I think we really need a strong interim target. That's what the science tells us, and that's what basically most of the groups have been lobbying for, except for maybe the Business Council.
Yeah.
Seems pretty chuffed with Professor Ross Garnaut.
It seems like everyone's pretty upset except for the business community. I think what's depressing here is the fact that what Garnaut actually does know is going to happen. Like the fact that he's saying, yeah, we're never going to keep the Great Barrier Reef, we're going to lose the Murray, all that stuff. Like, and yet he's still aiming lower.
Yeah, and it's still hard to conceive of things like the Great Barrier Reef disappearing, or irrigation in the Murray reducing by, I think you said, 48%. Now 48%. I mean, that's half of our. Sure, that's like half of our food production gone.
Yeah, it's just totally destroying our own self-determination in terms of how we, you know, feed ourselves, nourish ourselves. All these basic human needs are just being destroyed.
Oh, angry.
Very, very angry. Yes, we are. And just in continuance of anger.
Another thing a lot of people have been angry about.
Yep. A lot of people are angry. And in this country, a lot of horrible things are happening to a lot of people. Later this month in response to some of that anger. The Darwin Aboriginal Rights Coalition is holding the Darwin to Alice Springs road trip against racism. Liv Negro, who has been working with the Darwin Aboriginal Rights Coalition for the last 6 months, has collated a report which assesses the impact that land rights policies around the intervention have had on uranium mining in the Northern Territory and the impact that that has on communities. The Third Degree's Jessica Minchell reports.
Basically, the intervention is a complex, multidimensional package of measures which includes a very explicit land reform agenda that is unrelated to the premise of the intervention, which is increasing child safety in Aboriginal communities. Now, what this land reform agenda entails is the suspension of certain sections of the Aboriginal Land Rights Act and the Native Title Act in the prescribed areas, which now span over 98 communities. What this has involved has been a compulsory acquisition of land in those communities for up to 5 years, giving the Minister of Indigenous Affairs exclusive control over those lands and the power to actually extend the duration and size of the lease at any time without putting it through Parliament. In the initial stages of the intervention, this land reform agenda saw the disabling of the permit system. And for people who don't know what the permit system is, it was a mechanism put in place to give traditional owners some control and autonomy over who had access to their communities and their lands. Now, despite fierce opposition from the Australian Police Federation and the Northern Territory Police, that permit system was disabled and there was a window of 9 months where permits were not required on Aboriginal land. Now, the feedback that I got from the Green Senator, Rachel Seward, was that during this nine-month period, mining companies were opportunistic in gaining land access and took the opportunity to go into Aboriginal communities and pressure traditional owners into agreements and contracts for mining exploration on their country.
The figures and the statements that you have collated in this report do draw out how the withdrawing of government investment for basic services in the Northern Territory and the attempt to channel private royalty money into public services and infrastructure has also allowed the expansion of, in particular, uranium mining in the Northern Territory. Could you explain that?
Well, basically, the Intervention Task Force, in its one-year report, made a recommendation that the government assess the viability of Aboriginal communities, and communities that were deemed unviable would therefore have government funding withdrawn for basic services such as education, health and infrastructure.
And what's the viability looking for there?
The prescriptions around what will be considered viable and non-viable have been very vague and they haven't actually released any criteria as yet.
But it's meant to be getting to the idea of whether that community can exist in the area?
Yeah, basically whether the community will receive future government funding for basic services. So only viable communities will receive future government funding. Now, this is obviously extremely serious in terms of denying people of their citizenship rights, but it's also serious within the context of a large-scale push for mining because it's basically a coercive method to encourage Aboriginal communities to sign on to contracts with mining companies who will provide those services. And Kevin Rudd has explicitly stated that their blueprint for closing the gap will be a three-way partnership between major corporations, the Australian government and communities. And he's actually explicitly advocating for the corporatisation of service delivery in Aboriginal communities. So it's very concerning that the government is potentially going to withdraw funding from certain communities because it'll basically give communities no other option than to sign onto contracts with large-scale corporations if they want to receive their basic services.
What level of uranium mining expansion has taken place since the introduction of the Northern Territory intervention?
Well, the Northern Territory intervention, interestingly, emerged at a time of a fierce national campaign for the expansion of the uranium industry. You know, Martin Ferguson stated a few months ago that his vision for Australia is to be the world's largest exporter and miner of uranium, and 40% of the world's uranium actually lies under Aboriginal land. Now, at the moment, 80% of the Northern Territory is up for or currently under exploration, not for just for uranium, for all types of mining, but there has been a significant increase in the number of uranium exploration licences that have been granted. So since January last year, there have been over 430 exploration licences granted in the Northern Territory, and 214 of these have been granted to companies with specific uranium interests. And out of these 214, over 150 of those exploration licences have been granted to uranium companies since the intervention was announced.
Is that a far greater figure than the similar period the year before?
Oh, yes. There's been an exponential increase in both the number of exploration licences granted as well as government funding for uranium exploration.
But the communities in the Northern Territory are organising around this. The Australian Nuclear Free Alliance, ANFI, held a large meeting recently.
Yep.
What is the significance of such a meeting and what has come out of it?
Basically, the Australian Nuclear Free Alliance gives traditional owners on country that has been affected by the nuclear industry the opportunity to come together, to share their stories, to support each other, and to develop strategy around how they're going to take on the aggressive nuclear industry and its devastating effects on their country. So at the end of August, the meeting was held in the Top End. Several commitments were made, one of which was a call for the Aboriginal Land Rights Act that combines the exploration and mining consent into one process to be actually separated. And they also called for rehabilitation of poison lands to be guaranteed.
And that was Jessica Minchell speaking with Liv Negro. So about the road trip against racism, which is happening from Darwin to Alice Springs, starting on the 26th of September. There's the Top End Rally at 10 a.m, Raintree Park in Darwin. And then the bus leaves Raintree Park for the Freedom Rides to Alice Springs, where there's going to be a week of touring communities and listening to Indigenous people there and having rallies saying stop the intervention. And there's a few more events that are also coming up.
There are. Just to remind you again, we had Nina Hall from Climate Action Coogee and before talking about the Climate Protection Bill, which will be in Canberra later this month. You can support that bill by heading to the Climate Protection Rally in Canberra Federation Square on September 21st.
And also happening on the 21st of September, the 20th to the 21st, if you can't make it to Canberra, head to Tarramurra instead, where there's a biodiversity conference with speakers including Dr. Jack Mundy, Lee Rhiannon, and other wonderful people.
And on September 18th, the Whitlam Institute and the UWS College of Health and Science are presenting the last in a series of forums, Energy Security, The Real Story. This one is going to be about powering the future, and we'll have Dr. Brett Drake from the Smithsonian Institute. I think it's around $10 or $15 at the Parramatta Riverside Theatre.
Lovely.
And all the details of those events and podcasts and all other wonderful stuff will be on our website.
Our wonderful website. What's our website,
it's
James?
It's climateradio.blogspot.com. And we've been the Third Degree Climate Justice Radio.
On 2SER 107.3.